Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared create collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
So my next interview is with Peter Gajdich, and we talk about a lot of things in this interview, and really what we start with is about his book, The Inheritance of Shame, a book that was just published this year in April by Brown Paper Press. And we get into it right away. I mean, we touch on pretty much everything: authenticity, trauma, memory, forgiveness, hatred. This is a very personal story that Peter tells about his life, about his, as he talks about how he's got a lot more living and forgiving to do, which I think is absolutely beautiful. And I'm looking forward to doing a part two with him, and feel really blessed and to have just been able to get to know him a little bit more and to have read his story. So you're not only going to want to listen to the interview, but I think you're going to want to get out and get the book, again, The Inheritance of Shame. You can check more about it online as well, theinheritanceofshame.com, and it's there that you can find out about Peter, events, speaking, media, a little bit about shame, a little bit about conversion therapy, and so on. Don't forget facetofacelive.ca for more podcasting. Toronto International Film Festival is coming up. It's going to be kind of fast, and hopefully not so furious, but I hope it's going to be engaging and meet you on a whole lot of different levels. They got some great films lined up. And don't forget rabble.ca for more information too about my podcasting. And if you'd really like to get behind me and support what I do, you can do that through patreon.com. Coming right up, The Inheritance of Shame, and one of my favorite interviews in the last little while with Peter Gajdich. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by a very special guest today. Peter Gajdich is here with us today to talk about his new book, The Inheritance of Shame, a memoir. And it is recently published in 2017 by Brown Paper Press. Peter, thanks for joining us today, all the way from Vancouver.
Yes. Sunny but turning to fall Vancouver.
Nice. I wish I could say that we were actually face to face instead of digitally face to face here, and that we here at Face to Face had the budget to fly you into Toronto to do this interview.
Wouldn't that be nice? This is great though.
Yeah, it really is. It's not a bad second, is it?
No.
So the Inheritance of Shame, Peter, congratulations on a remarkable book, on a beautiful book about a tragically beautiful story. Can you bring us in before I sort of say anything about it? As to it sounds to me like it was about a 20-year project, from when you started writing, going through journals and memory, and memory is such an important theme in the work, but it truly is a very personal and at times difficult to read memoir. Can you kind of provide a little bit of insight as almost like the back page blurb for our listeners?
Well, in terms of the 20 years, it's true, and it ironically, it almost turned out to be 20 years to the day.
Is that right?
because the process started when I reported this doctor, my former psychiatrist, to the College of Physicians and Surgeons in British Columbia in 1997 on May 3rd. And the book was published on May 16th, 2017. And that five-page complaint letter about my doctor formed the basis for the book that eventually I went on to write. So really, it started in 1997. I don't know if you want me to give you more of the context of the story.
I think that would be a great idea. I mean, I'm here. Can I start that?
Please.
So for me, the book is about authenticity. It's about truth and trauma and therapy. It's about memory and story. It's about community. It's about hatred. It's about healing and anger and parenting and love and inclusion and psychotherapy and shame and guilt and abuse. I'm not sure you left anything out. So I think you can hear my passionate take on this. You've touched so many important themes in such a transparent, authentic human way. So I'll use that as sort of our touch point for you to take us in a little deeper.
Oh, well, I really appreciate that. And those are the themes of the book, whether I intended to touch on them or not. It's just that was the story, which was trying to be brief, which was basically after I came out as gay to my family, my Catholic family, it went terribly wrong. They rejected me, and I fled my hometown to escape that sort of isolation and the arguments that prevailed. And I was even more depressed and suicidal. And so I went to my doctor, and he referred me to a psychiatrist because psychiatry is covered under our healthcare plan. And I was young and a student. And that's when I met this doctor and started therapy with him, psychotherapy. And very early, not at the beginning, but within a few months of the therapy, he told me that it was my homosexuality that had caused me all of my life's distress. And the only way to recover from this sense of pain and isolation I felt was to, in his words, correct my homosexuality, to revert me to my innate heterosexuality. And I'd originally sought treatment in large part because I'd been sexually abused as a child, and I had grown up in the 1970s with this pervasive ideology from the church, my family, the culture, the media, that sexual abuse did make a person gay, or at least you should be feared that it might. You know, the whole predatory homosexual that was, you know, sort of in the media of the 70s. And so I grew up with this haunting fear that this was the truth of my life. And I resisted it. I mean, I came out, I had gay friends, I dated, but it was lurking in the background. And when my family rejected me and I went to this doctor, he just, his beliefs that this was true, that the sexual abuse had made me gay, it just fit the narrative of my upbringing. And I was hooked, you could say, in the sense of wanting to do anything he said I should do to recover from my pain, to escape that pain. And so the therapy lasted 6 years. I was in this therapy 6 years, and the bulk of it, I was living in a house with other patients. He had me move into a psychotherapy house that he called the Styx, STYX, and we did our therapy in the house and in the office. And the therapy, in essence, quickly turned into a form of conversion therapy. But those terms were never used. And remembering that this was also late 80s, early 90s, right, these terms weren't really in the media like they are today. Well, I don't even know that they were at all. But this was the essence of what was happening for 6 years. And after those 6 years, I left and suffered through the first couple of years of terrible PTSD. And even then, I wasn't using PTSD as a phrase. So, you know, this language is helpful in retrospect. But at the time, it was just overwhelming anxiety, worse despair, and grief, just sort of a lack of comprehension over what had happened in my life. The way I've written about it in the book is it felt as if a storm had passed through my body, like a tornado through a field, and my body had been left in just rubble.
So many of us want to look for the reason why something like this occurs. And so I guess this form of psychotherapy, if we can even call it that, sounds to me like it's being too kind, frankly, but is looking for this a moment or this event, or we want to blame our upbringing. We want to blame, you know, your parents and their backgrounds, the political backgrounds, the war that they'd been through, the trauma that they'd suffered. You know, where, how far does this go back? You know, these are all these questions that we ask. Is there a sense that you have something you can put your finger on? You know, you talk a lot about silence, Peter. You talk a lot about the inability. I'm just going to read this beautiful little piece here about your father. I kiss my parents goodnight in the living room before bed every night when I was a young boy, but my father's body was wooden and unresponsive, like my hugs were not a language he understood, close quote. It's so beautiful, and you just finished speaking so eloquently about language. Silence is a form of language, I suppose, or at least an act of communication. Is any of that making sense?
Completely. And it's interesting because there was silence in my home. At the same time, it was a loud presence with the knowledge that my parents had lived through war. I mean, I grew up understanding fully that my mother had been in 3 years concentration camp, communist concentration camp in the former Yugoslavia. But I knew this in a way that it was like, well, aren't all mothers
right
in concentration camps? I mean, it was just a given. I think it's common knowledge. We all think that whatever our parents' histories are is just normal until we know differently.
Right.
And so this was the loud understanding, and at the same time a silence around speaking and asking questions about their history, which we were forbidden.
And at some point you were able to break that down. You were able to break through that at some point, but it took years of years of therapy and pseudotherapy and medication and community and I guess detailing your memoir in a way, I suppose, would have. In fact, you talk about the act of healing through the writing, through the memory. In fact, don't you end the book that way? I read a review. You talk about remembering is essentially the way what brings you peace.
Absolutely, because for so many years I was in effect told not to remember. I was told by the doctor to not remember because he denied everything. When I finally reported him and then sued him, he denied everything, which is a form of not remembering, right? And then the legal system, well, starting with the college, it was a form of not remembering because there was a denial on some level of the catastrophe of the situation. And the legal system, I felt, failed in the same way. And then my family, and then even guys I dated after the therapy, eventually when I went back and, you know, sort of took up my life again. And, you know, there was this sense of, just move on. Don't think, don't remember. And I couldn't do that. And to me, it wasn't this moral high ground of remembering. It was in not remembering, in succumbing to the silence, it felt like a form of death to me. Because the trauma was prevalent regardless. To address it, to recognize it, to speak it was a form of healing, was to say that this thing had happened and I had survived and this is what I've learned. And that's the way of moving forward.
Would you say that if you had had and obviously not looking to point any fingers or necessarily put specific blame on anyone here, but if you had more of a friendly environment where, you know, people were able to listen, where hugs were seen as a form of intimate language, and you were able to connect with your mom and your dad in a very particular way, and your siblings. It sounded like you had some pretty close friends, Pearl and others that ultimately, I guess, you kind of pushed away on some level. But or was it way deeper than that, Peter? I mean, it's not just about being able to express your story, or is it?
Well, in terms of my parents, you know, the paradox here, which I don't think is too uncommon for a lot of people, is that the love and the safety, ironically, that was also present in my family, in effect, saved me from completely being taken under the currents of this silence and dismissal and evasiveness and of the trauma, their trauma, but also mine, you know, the childhood sexual abuse, which was not spoken of as well. So I did, there was an element of safety in my home. I mean, from the outside, I grew up in an upper middle class, West Vancouver side home, Catholic schools, you know, with the uniforms and the whole thing,
right.
Piano lessons and with parents from Europe. So, you know, steeped in a deep sense of culture and music and art and film. So there was this real nurturing environment, very much in one respect. But trauma was always in the background.
Right.
And the silence of that trauma was almost like an undoing of everything else. It buried me.
And were your parents taught, you know, that voicing these things was inappropriate, was not the right way to healing or towards healing? Or was that not even a conversation that they were willing to entertain?
Not even a conversation. I mean, my parents, as I've said, came from Europe. My father from Hungary. My mom is German national, but living in the former Yugoslavia, where there were a lot of Germans, especially at that time, before and after World War II. And so this is their generation and their culture. You know, trauma, which they lived firsthand, was at the same time not something that was discussed. I mean, people didn't go into therapy. People didn't, you know,
right.
go out and talk about their feelings like this.
Yeah, it was, yeah, let's just, we sweep it under the carpet and we hope and trust and pray that it goes away.
And they did what they needed to do in order to survive. And now, in my life and through the writing of this book especially, I've learned that and I've understood that and it's helped me heal. But at the time, it was just this deafening silence. It was just, you know, there was like a volcano in my body, and yet it had no place to release itself, no avenue.
Peter, how do you define dysfunction? Or how would you talk about it, I suppose? Maybe definition's too black and white.
Dysfunction, well... You know, when you asked that, the first thing that came to my mind was even something in my book. When I talk about the breaking apart of something that was meant to remain whole, I think that's how I describe it, but something to that effect. And to me, that was part of the, you know, these are not words I necessarily would have used, dysfunction, but I think this is part of it, because of course you think the word function, what is functionality? And it seems to me that it's a breaking apart of something that was whole and should have remained whole, and then you know, you scramble to make it work as best you can, but it's from a place of brokenness.
And would you say we're all broken in our own ways?
You know, I think it's funny. I think about another part in the book where one of the psychiatrists who was hired to interview me, that defense had hired to interview me. In his report about me, he makes some comment. Now I'm having trouble remembering it exactly. But I just think the human to be human is in some sense. I don't want to say broken, to be broken, because I don't think all people are broken to such degree, but. I think it's part of what it means to be human to reconcile with these issues.
Yeah, a friend of mine refers to them as the I am nots. You know, I'm not worthy. I'm not beautiful. I'm not accepted. I'm not included, and so on. And I know I certainly suffer from a few of those. I have a fairly long list, I suppose. And so how do we actually find healing? And I think, and this is what's so beautiful to me about your book and about your story, is that it seems to be found in others. It seems to be found in, you know, the antithesis of silence, which to me is communication and relationship and intimacy and inclusion, not exclusion. You know, this sort of circle of embrace, if that makes any sense.
Completely. I guess I was where I was going is I'm hesitant to say that all people, you know, have extreme trauma.
Right. Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. No, yeah, that makes sense. There's a piece here where you say, you're talking, I'm just, the line is, in essence, our pact had bound me to a deafening silence, and beneath my silence, festering rage, close quote, out of the book. Yeah. You don't strike me as a very angry person at all, Peter, and we've only been chatting for about 25 minutes. Where does that rage go? And maybe, can you talk a little bit about some of that primal therapy that primal therapy in quotes, I guess. I don't know. Would you? Yeah. Anyway, I've got so many questions, but yeah, if please go ahead.
Well, I mean, in terms of the primal therapy, this is what the doctor practiced, and this is formed the basis of all of my treatment, primal therapy, which very briefly is a type of therapy that was created, discovered or whatever by this psychotherapist Arthur Janov in LA in the late 1960s, who my doctor actually studied with as a patient. He was actually one of Janov's original patients. So it basically says that all trauma can only be healed by the re-experiencing of it through these what are called primal regressions, screaming, raging, using a baseball bat and thumping a mattress and you know, crying and wailing. So this is the only way of healing the trauma. So what my doctor did with me in particular was, because my damage was my the sexual abuse that had made me gay, all of my primals, as it were focused about re-experiencing, or a lot of my primals were about re-experiencing this sexual abuse, you know, crying and screaming and batting a mattress in an effort to revert my sexuality back to heterosexuality. So that's how the primal therapy in itself went sideways. I mean, I think primal therapy is a pretty dangerous animal to use on patients, because it sort of presupposes that the therapist is so healthy that they won't, there won't be any boundary violation. When a person is regressed in this state, and it's a very real experience, I mean, regressed, I'm not talking past life regressions, there's nothing hooey-dooey about it. It's just very much sinking into a infantile state, crying, and vulnerable is another word to use, an extremely vulnerable state. All guards are let down, and we have to assume that the therapist or counselor isn't going to make any sort of invasion of any sort. I mean, I'm not even talking physical, just emotional invasion, sure. Misconstruing a person's history, which certainly happened with mine, redirecting them in ways that take their life and therapy way off course. So that's what happened with me and the primal.
And it's interesting what you say. I want to come back to the anger in a second, and the rage. You talk about vulnerability. I mean, I don't know that I've read a book where an author is more vulnerable in a sense. And I wonder, you're not saying vulnerability is a negative thing, or we shouldn't work towards that. But in a loving community, it makes perfect sense.
Absolutely. And I think, having experienced this therapy, if you can call it that, I'm not anti-therapy. I mean, I've since this experience have seen a woman, a counselor, for many years, and she's really helped, Jungian, you know, and it's really helped to have that place of safety to say things that I might not want to say to a friend. I might not want to burden them. So vulnerability is absolutely essential, I think, as to be human. We are vulnerable. I mean, You can pretend you're not vulnerable, but I mean, if you shoot a gun at a body, the body dies. How vulnerable is that? I mean, you cannot escape the fact that we are mortal beings, right? With all the vulnerabilities.
So back to the earlier question, where is the anger? You know, this to me is a book about, this book has to be about forgiveness. And this is something clearly you've wrestled with and struggled with. I mean, it seems like there's so many people in your life that you needed to forgive. Whether or not they came to you and asked for it, I guess, is another question. But
well, starting with the anger, where is the anger? This is where it's almost like splitting hairs, and it's a very delicate issue to discuss, because in one way I would never condone what had happened to me, or the methods of this therapy, certainly not the methodologies of conversion therapy. There were particular things about this therapy, the form of the therapy, not the way in which the doctor used it, that actually did help me.
Right.
And so there was a coexistence of the two. Some of the screaming, in a structured, safe environment, released certainly years of pent up anger. I mean, where does the anger go when you're constantly being told as a child, don't get angry, you can be beaten, but don't get angry. Yeah, you have the experience of sexual assault in your body, that violation. No, but don't get angry.
Well, and your father directly telling you to forget about your past. So, we're not going to talk about it today, tomorrow, or ever. So do something. Get it rid of it somewhere, but not here.
So where does it go? And for me, it remained in my body, and I became extremely depressed and suicidal. And that was my story. And so when I started this treatment with this doctor, and I had the availability of screaming and using a baseball bat and a structure, I mean, some of these things certainly help. I mentioned that briefly because I think mostly the therapy went totally off course because of the man and the way he used these treatments. The other thing about the anger, where did it go, is writing this book has helped me heal in more ways than I could explain to you briefly.
I can imagine.
And just the process of, and not just the physical act of writing, but everything that I needed to think about and process and come to terms with in the writing of the book has helped me heal. And, anger can be a motivating force, certainly politically,
right?
But it can be a flame that burns itself out. And so I do think compassion and love is a much stronger force to live by. And there were times in the writing of this book, specific things happened where I actually felt like I was standing at a fork in a road, where I could continue with the anger, that sense of injustice, this exists regardless. I mean, there was a sense of injustice that occurred, but in terms of my response to it, I could stay with that anger, or try to move into a place of compassion, which to me means understanding. Understanding. Why did this happen? What led me to this experience? And not just in my own life, but my parents, because I'm like one speck in the history of humanity, right? So, I mean, it's not just about me and my little life. It's about, what came before me. And I just happened to plop down at that moment in time, and I carried it forth. Trauma, I think, and oppression is almost like a force outside of us that comes through our lives, and we encounter it, and we can either go with it and carry it forth, like as oppressors, or we resist it and we make change in a positive way. It's not just about me and my drama. I mean, that's part of it.
Peter, did you have to be, so it sounds like very much a choice on some levels, but I would never want to make it something so existentially simple as that. It's not, I mean, there were all kinds of things that had to happen, it seems to me, in order for Absolutely. You to get to a place to make that choice.
Oh, sure. It wasn't I am trying to be brief. It wasn't one day sitting down, oh, I have a choice here. And in fact, I never thought in those terms. But in retrospect, I can certainly see these were the issues I had to wrestle with during the writing of the book. I mean, 20 years is a long time. And part of that wasn't just, you know, writing, you know, on a typewriter the book. It was
right.
Dealing with the issues and trying to understand.
Well, I think any good poet or any great writer is you're kind of constantly writing, even if you're not actually the physical act of writing is the one thing. It's the experience that leads your fingers to bang out the text, right? So you're sort of writing it as you go. I love how when you're talking about some others who were being, I think, introduced into Styx, into the community, into this, you know, cult-like atmosphere or cult, as I think others have certainly called it. These are folks that couldn't actually deal with what was happening. They sort of stepped into it, and then, you know, they got into their cars and they left. And you say here that eventually, no matter what their tax bracket, everyone bled red. And there was something for me that just really leapt out of the page there. I mean, we're all in this together on one hand, I suppose. And yet for me, that was a real leveler in your story.
Absolutely. I mean, in the years that I lived in this house called the Styx, I saw hundreds, if not thousands of people come through. I mean, there were the core, we called them family members that lived there. But we had these groups called intensives, like two or three people at a time that would come in for 3 weeks and then leave. And it just kept going. And, you know, this within the context of these types of quote, crazy therapies, these feeling therapies from the 60s and 70s. As I learned years after leaving my own experience, this was actually very common, that these types of communities were set up and they would have these, even the term intensive was not one my doctor invented. I mean, we use this, but I read in other books that these were terms used, intensives. So I saw many people come, and when you see somebody lie on a mattress and regress and start crying about their mother that never loved them and their father that dismissed them, I mean, when you see it time and again, it's just suddenly, you know, their face disappears and you just see that we are all connected on some level with the same primal needs and vulnerabilities and desires. I mean, we're all connected on that level.
Yeah, I've done a fair bit of traveling over the years, and with the work that I do, and I've just been blessed and fortunate to have done that. And I think as I get older, I'm looking for the commonalities. There's so many differences immediately, the smells and the tastes and the color of skin, and yet there's so many similarities. I mean, isn't it about similarity through difference, Peter?
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, and I love what you said earlier about love and compassion. How the heck did you actually finish the book? That's what I want to know. So 20 years in the making. I mean, talk about a choice every day. I've done a little bit of writing. It's not easy. This is and for my listeners, this is one of the most transparent, authentic, vulnerable stories I've ever read. So again, thanks for that. And what an honor and a blessing to be able to step inside of that, Peter. And I think that there's so much value here for others, and I'm sure it was deeply therapeutic for you, but the reading of it has been therapeutic for me, and I know that others will feel the same. How did you get it finished? You know, are you a heavy drinker? You know, is it all the Grey Goose vodka?
I wish I could say so. I do like martinis, but no, you know, as I said at the beginning, I felt compelled to speak initially through this complaint against the doctor and then to write because the opposite to me was silence, and silence felt like certain death. When you're faced with this level of depression and isolation, you know, to break through it, you have to speak. That's I was a writer before the therapy, and so writing to me was my way of speaking. So I continue to speak by writing, and it took on many structures through the years. From beginning, it was simply to map out what had happened, because as I said, it left me in a shambles. I couldn't even wrap my head around what had happened. So I mapped it out. You know, literally, I met the doctor on this day. I took this much medication. It had this side effect. Then he added this medication, on and on. Eventually, I needed to do more than write facts. And so I tried to understand, you know, going back into my life, my childhood, and then eventually my parents. When you travel backward, you just can keep going, right? And so that was part of the writing where I was learning to understand what had brought me to this doctor, why I had stayed after for 6 years. Some people would have left day one. I mean, he did something on the first day that was shocking enough that some people would have just stood up and said, well, okay, not for me, and walked out the door. And I went back. And then eventually, as I moved through that part of the writing, funny enough, these phrases, reparative therapy, conversion therapy, which I had been writing about all along but never really used those terms, began appearing in the press because of the laws that are happening in the States and even in Canada. And so this just sort of validated what I was doing. I mean, it's part of a cultural narrative now, actually. I mean, there's so much going on around conversion therapy. And it sort of validated that this needed to be told. I mean, one of my goals has always been to prevent, you know, the recurrence of this type of thing from happening again, whether it's conversion therapy or quote, simply this type of violation of trust between a doctor and a patient, because that's basically what it was. It was an extreme violation of boundaries and trust.
You know, you wind up at the end of the book on peace and love. You're asked to give the eulogy at your father's funeral, and you write about your dad in such a touching way. And you know, we're back to anger in a little. Where's the anger towards your parents? And yet, it I'm sure there's edges of it. But you say here that I went on to say, quote, what I believe. The mark of any man, however, is the love he brings to the world in spite of his pain. The mark of any person is the love that lives on in the hearts of those who knew him. And it goes on, love does heal wounds, and there is no doubt to anyone who ever knew my father that he loved deeply. Close quote. It's a beautiful way to end the book, and then you go on to say, I need to remember in order to find peace. I think I know where the love came from. I think if I was you, I would know. I hope I would feel the same way, Peter. But I have to say, I'm kind of stunned in a way by that, if you know what I mean. There's this level of admiration there. How do you get there? Was that after years of also working through those issues with your family as well that you were able there, or would you say that you never lost that throughout?
Well, that's interesting, because what I was going to say is, and it's certainly been true in my life, I would like to think that it's true of all, but that the love is what was always present. Mm. It was in the background. It was the foundation. And the love gets lost with clouds of anger and betrayal and violation and silencing. I mean, it's like clouds moving in over the love. And the experience over many years, and then the writing of the book and everything that happened around that, in a sense, helped clear away those clouds. I mean, look, I'm only, quote, 52 years old. I have a lot more living and forgiving to do.
Nice.
And wrestling with, you know, anger and, you know, these are all human traits. But I did find a place of peace with my father and my mother as well, but very much my father, through a very strange turn of events, which I write about it near the end of the book. And briefly, because I don't want to give too much of the book away, but briefly, you know, when I came back and attempted to reestablish a relationship with my parents, strange things started happening in this respect, in that they started to talk more about their lives, which had been absent from my childhood. And my father and I in particular developed this interesting relationship where he told me more than my siblings about his history in Hungary and what he had been through as a child. And this really was so healing for me and I'm sure for him too. And you know, at the end of the day, this is what we all want. We just want that level of intimacy. You know, there were no big parades. I knew nice. My father always loved me. I always loved my father, but there was so much sort of second guessing and doubts and yes, betrayal and that got in the way. And I guess also at the you know toward the end of his life, there was much more vulnerability, which is a beautiful thing. And it allowed us to speak more directly with each other.
Yeah, I had a very similar experience with my dad. He ended up in the hospital. He had been suffering with Parkinson's disease for many years, Peter. And they ended up doing, I can't even remember the name of the surgery, but they ended up putting in two titanium rods down his cervical spines. Five or six of the discs had deteriorated. And so he ended up getting sepsis. And it was a mess. And so he was on medications and he had the infection and wasn't sleeping properly, plus the Parkinson's and so on. And you know, what's so interesting and ironic is that under the medication and dealing with the disease and this illness, we had some of the most lucid and interesting and open and authentic conversations. And it was there that, love was always there in my family in a deep, deep, intimate way for sure. But, you know, you look back and you go, gee, I wonder if things had been a little different. What if, you know, the what if questions sometimes haunt me. But my dad and I were able to connect in a way that we had never done before. And how odd, you know, I guess maybe it's mortality or the, you know, bearing down that allowed the door to open. But isn't it? I mean, this is what is so interesting and ironic to me about your book, The Inheritance of Shame. Your new book, The Inheritance of Shame, is that you're attending to the violence by writing, what, 352 pages. Your story, telling others, is what's, I believe, going to allow others not only in, but the access and the freedom to hopefully tell theirs.
I hope so, because it's so important. You know, right now I'm reading Roxane Gay's book, Hunger, which is like number one everywhere. And it's amazing. And this is what she's doing, right? I mean, so many people have done it before me and will continue to do it after. Just stripping away and speaking from that vulnerable place. And when I read her book and others that I've read like it, it just speaks to me so directly that, once again, we are all the same. And when we are able to speak from this vulnerable place, we just connect with our humanity, with each other's humanity. You know, we get lost in all of our political differences, right? And
yes.
Religious differences. But beneath it all, there is this one humanity.
Yeah, and I think you're right, and I would argue, and I think, you know, I don't even think I'd have to argue it, but I would, you know, have a long conversation with anyone about this idea of everyone bleeding red, you know, to quote you, in the sense that I think what we all need and what we're all really desiring is that intimacy, that inclusion, that embrace, if you will, back to full circle to the hugs as being a form of language, you know, the kind of the way you start the book. I mean, isn't that what we all are really craving in some way? And I'm not even sure that we know that, you know.
You know, and I also don't want to make it sound too simplistic.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not. I mean, there's nothing harder than
yeah.
this.
Yeah.
I mean, I have a relationship with my family, despite years of turmoil, but it's not easy because, you know, in particular, a couple of people in the family, as well as my mother, are so politically different, I could say. Then,
is that your, is that going to be the topic of your next book? Is that what you're saying, Peter?
You know, I touch on it here, obviously. But, you know, it's interesting. We were always raised with this sort of liveliness in the family. You know, just although my parents would not talk about trauma, they talked endlessly about European politics.
Mm.
So there's a strange mix in the air, right? It was always very lively. And so I was raised with this type, you know, ideologies in the air and politics and talk of religions. And but it's very difficult. I mean, it's very difficult to see one of my siblings and hear him giving it away, you know, speak about his love of Trump, for instance, and just sort of hang on to
right.
the relationship, right? It's a very challenging thing.
Yeah, finding common ground, right?
Yeah.
Finding common ground. How do we step into another worldview? How do we step into another theology or philosophy or whatever it is? I mean, what's going on in the States right now? Well, it's not just the States. I mean, it's everywhere. But recently with Charlottesville, I mean, you just how do you have a conversation? How do you reach out and embrace that person that you so clearly, ideologically, vehemently disagree with and say, you know, we can, how do we get to the next phase? How do I love this person? And with the hope and that, you know, that we are going to step into some sort of significant kind of social change. I mean, yeah, I don't know what the answer to that is, although I think part of it is that we do need to have, I don't know, have the faith to keep trying. Be willing to, you know, as Kierkegaard says, you know, to, you know, just to continue to take those steps. And the only way we're going to do it is by stepping into it. And the only way we're going to understand it is when we look back and hopefully it's going to make some kind of sense. Anyway, Peter, we're going to have to wrap up. I'm so sorry. I could talk to you for hours. In fact, I think we need to do a part two. I hope you'll consider that. Mike Liu, author of Victims No Longer, says this, quote, "His healing speaks to the power and fortitude of the human spirit. The inheritance of shame is both about damage and healing. This is a work of love," close quote. It really is a remarkable book. I can't wait to finish it. I'm only about 50 or 60 pages away. What's next for you, Peter?
Well, I am working on a piece of fiction, and you know, and I hope all novelists don't hate me for saying this, but it feels like a cop out to write fiction after writing about this type of thing. I mean, in the sense that, you know, the world feels so urgent to me, the reality of what's happening in the world, even my own world, that to write fiction feels like, you know, a side story. But I am working on a piece of fiction. I just got a Canada Council grant.
Nice.
For this next project. But you know, the book has just come out. I mean, I'm wanting to write some essays about certain
Great.
Things I touch on in the book but didn't explore. So all of that's going on.
Well, I think, you know, again, congratulations. I think it could be a launching point for a new kind of therapy. You know, I mean, maybe not, but there's so much to mine here, it seems to me. And I, you know, I started out by all the listing the things that I felt the book was about. I'm sure I didn't touch on them all, but thank you for such a remarkable, authentic, and transformative read. I really, really do appreciate your time today, Peter.
Well, I appreciate your time, so thanks very much.